Good morning. It's 8:06. Thanks for tuning in to the local news hour on KPCW on this Tuesday, October 14th. I'm Connor Thomas, filling in for Leslie this morning. It was a foggy one. Early birds were treated to pretty pea soup around the Snyderville Basin and Park City area. Don't have a camera angle on it right now, but looks like most of it has burned off with outlook on the weather to come. We have ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Happy Tuesday, KPCW listeners. We're looking at partly cloudy skies as we move throughout the day. The morning rains basically come to an end. Otherwise, an isolated spotty shower possible. High temperatures for your Tuesday would climb near 60 in Park City. We'll see those highs climbing into the mid-60s there in the Heber Valley. As we go into your Wednesday, we're looking at periods of showers and thunderstorms moving across the area as we go throughout the day as a strong cold front begins to make its way through the area. Now, that cold front will bring in some colder air as well, so by the time we get towards your Wednesday afternoon into Wednesday evening, those snow levels will be dropping down to around 6,500 to 7,000 feet, and that's going to mean any rain left over will change over to snow as we move throughout your Tuesday evening into Tuesday night. There's the potential of about 1 to 4 inches of snow on average above 7,000 feet. And of course, some areas, especially in the high country, could see a little bit more than that. But otherwise, temperatures for highs will be in the 40s in Park City, and we'll see those highs only in the low 50s in the Heber Valley. As we move into your Wednesday night and a Thursday, that cold air will continue to work its way in, and we could see still a couple of periods of scattered showers rotating through the area. So because of that, we could be talking about some snow showers moving in, especially as we get towards your Wednesday night into your Thursday morning. As temperatures drop down to near freezing, we'll be near freezing in the Heber Valley as well, with temperatures right around that freezing mark there, with highs only in the 40s for Heber Valley. As we go towards your Thursday, we'll only be in the 30s for highs in the Park City area. As we get towards your Friday, temperatures once again could be dropping below freezing to kick off the day, with partly cloudy skies, though just a very slim chance of a shower. High temperatures climbing into the 40s in Park City, and we should be back in the low 50s in the Heber Valley. Once we get towards your upcoming weekend, we're looking at mostly sunny skies, chilly temperatures, but a nice weekend overall, very fall-like. Temperatures for lows down around freezing and highs in the 50s in the Park City area, with highs in the low 60s in the Heber Valley. That's a look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Well, looking at traffic in the Wasatch Back, the Utah Department of Transportation does not report any accidents right now. However, the westbound roads around the mouth of Parley's Canyon, the West 215, West 80 area, do look to be pretty full of cars. And then there's the usual delay on the eastbound I-80 exit at Silver Creek Junction there onto 40. That ramp is pretty delayed, more than usual at this hour, I'd say, almost back to the Kimball Junction area near Swanner there. So budget some extra time if those are your commute avenues. Otherwise, looks to be smooth sailing this morning in the Wasatch Back. Crews have completed preliminary work on High Valley Transit's State Route 224 bus rapid transit project. The construction included improving drainage and utilities, as well as removing large medians between Sun Peak Drive and White Pine Canyon Road. High Valley Transit says electrical crews will keep working through the end of November to finish signal work. Next spring, Route 224 will be widened to add two extra bus lanes. In Park City, Homestake Road has reopened to local traffic as crews put the final touches on that project. Residents will have access to the road while work wraps on the new sidewalks and multi-use trail. Work will continue on that through the end of November. In the spring, landscaping with planters, grasses, and trees will be added. Local news is next.
O.C. Tanner Jewelers, a Park City destination for locals and world travelers for nearly 25 years, welcomes you to historic Main Street, where we offer fine Swiss timepieces and curated jewelry to celebrate life's most meaningful moments. O.C. Tanner, a proud supporter of KPCW at 416 Main Street and at octannerjewelers.com.
And of course, coming up later in the hour today, we'll be speaking with Summit County Manager Shane Scott about tomorrow's County Council meeting, including the beginning of budget season. Then South Summit Superintendent of Schools Greg Mon has an update from last night's board meeting, and the Christian Center of Park City's Executive Director Steve Richardson and Director of Counseling Susan Hammer stopped by to talk about upcoming educational programming. While Park City posted large year-over-year declines in lodging tax revenue for the second straight month, KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports it's driven by a dip in summer short-term rentals. Transient room tax revenue for July, one of the busiest summer months in Park City, declined nearly 10% compared to 2024. Transient room tax, or TRT, is imposed on rentals for stays less than 30 days. The TRT revenue for July 2025 at over $212,000 also fell short of the budget department's forecast by 4%. The data indicates a shift in lodging mix, according to a city staff report. Short-term rental revenue is declining, while traditional hotel revenue is going up slightly. Short-term rentals are largely bookings on websites like Airbnb and Vrbo. Park City's TRT revenue in June dropped over 20% year-over-year, which drew concerns from city council members. Excluding TRT, citywide sales tax distributions are up nearly 2% year-over-year and far ahead of budget expectations. The report said that represents broad-based strength across the tax base. Preliminary data for August shows a modest increase in lodging demand compared to the same period last year. Cell phone data for August also suggests levels roughly consistent with those in 2024. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
And Park City will host a transportation and mobility open house so residents can learn more about projects in and around town today. Senior Transportation Director Connor Campobasso says it's the city's first transportation-focused open house.
All the project managers will be there representing each of the projects, so a lot of them will bring either some kind of poster board or something to kind of talk through the different projects.
Featured projects include the citywide bus stop project to improve more than 80 bus stops on Park City transit routes. Campobasso says project managers with the city's Recreate 248 project will also be on hand with information.
The public can expect to see updated schedules. They can talk to us about what we are planning on doing, what we're going to be looking at further, what we're going to be analyzing.
Other featured projects and programs include the city's Dogs on Buses program, parking in Old Town, new pedestrian pathways, and winter bus services. There will be no formal presentation. The event is drop-in. Residents can stop in any time to the Park City Mark Party Room from 5 p.m. to 6:30 tonight. And in its quest to reimagine City Park as a community living room, the Heber City Council has picked a consulting firm to design improvements. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports.
Enhancing the park is part of Envision Central Heber's plans to bring new life to downtown. To help shape the project, the council hired the Salt Lake City consulting firm Terracon. Councilmember Sid Ostergaard says he thinks the city made the right choice after hours of interviews with companies.
They have done many projects like this throughout the state. You know, they know what they're doing.
Ostergaard says he's glad to see the company has experience applying for grants and finding other creative ways to fund its projects.
And that's huge for us as a city. We want to, you know, self-fund this park and the design of it and the building of it via, you know, going after grants and making sure that we're not using taxpayer money to do this.
He says all the ideas for the park are still just concepts. Design elements like an ice ribbon or a splash pad will rely on community feedback. The city must finalize its contract with Terracon, then it will move forward with public outreach and planning. Heber City already finished the first phase of reimagining the park. Its new Bandshell and Festival Street opened over the summer. Heber City is a financial supporter of KPCW. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
In studio with us now is Summit County's manager, Shane Scott. Good morning, Shane.
Good morning, Connor.
Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
We have a county council meeting tomorrow, as usual, and it's the beginning of budget season. You're proposing the fiscal year 26 budget. You know, in last year's budget season, the focus was a lot of public safety and code enforcement positions. Could you give a broad overview of what your focus in the proposed budget is this year?
Yes. And again, thanks for having me. You know, some people like Thanksgiving and others like Christmas, and I like budget season. It's the most wonderful time of the year. We are proposing an almost $100 million budget, and that sounds like a lot of money. It is a lot of money. One of the, I guess, the keys to me that I like to remind people is that if we recognize $1 million in grants, for example, that means our budget goes up $1 million. So $100 million is also a reflection of revenue as much as it is a reflection of expenses. We have to balance our budget. That's a requirement we have. So this year is mostly a reflection of a full year of the emergency services sales tax, which was the voter-approved tax almost two years ago. $100 million, we're not requesting it to go through truth in taxation or raise any property taxes. This budget's a reflection of the past few years where I have recommended actually to the council in the previous 2 years that we go through truth in taxation, and we haven't done so. So I think we've had some needs that we've kind of, if you've heard me on this program in the past talking about budgets, we've used the term kicking the can down the road. We've done that, I think, the past 2 years. This year is an opportunity for us to really catch up. It's really to reflect. We've asked staff over the last 2 years to hold off on some full-time employees, for example, and I think this year we're really trying to catch up.
And as you said, you've previously recommended a property tax increase, but you're not recommending that this year.
That's correct. One of the selling features, I believe, of the emergency services sales tax was there are various ways we can spend that money. It is mostly intended to mitigate the impacts of tourism. But one of the ways we talked about that was it could be an either-or scenario. We could go through truth in taxation or that we could pass this tax. We believe this tax will be paid mostly by visitors, so that was one of the selling features of the tax. And this year we're going to realize the entire year of 2024 of the tax, so it'll be an opportunity for us, like I said, to play some catch up, to recognize some of the needs we've had over the last couple of years that we haven't been able to meet.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but this is the first time the budget's brushed that $100 million threshold. It says in your presentation on the agenda for tomorrow that this is like about $1 million less than what the various department heads requested for their own individual department budgets. Could you talk about what's been happening behind the scenes in the run-up to budget season this year as far as requests?
Yes, and thank you to the budget committee. We have a committee that goes through and hears every department's presentation for the needs they have. So the budget committee really vets that out before I get my hands on the budget and we start making presentations to the council. So a lot of thanks to that. If you look at my slides, I have a list of the budget committee members, and we're expressing gratitude to them and their hard work. They've been meeting since June, actually. I think this budget, too, is a reflection of some recent studies. If you followed a couple of weeks ago, I made a presentation to the council with the facilities master plan. And in that plan, we have facilities needs, building needs, what we have from next year into 25 years in the future. So we're trying to plan for those as well. And this budget is a reflection of that. We have a lot of needs at the courthouse that we're going to hit the next couple of years. And we're trying to step that over years. We're doing a lot in the Skull Candy building next year. We're preparing that first floor for library space, council dais, DMV. So that's a real area of emphasis for us next year as well.
Do you have a move-in date for the Skull Candy building?
The organization Skull Candy has moved out, so we are able to get in there and do the necessary changes to the first floor. We believe we'll be in the spring, so it could be as soon as March or April.
Gotcha. All right, and back on the budget, 16 full-time employee positions. I'm assuming that's what FTE means in the proposal. Okay, 16 new positions requested. You're recommending 8. Which departments will those positions be in?
It's a various, and speaking of the Skull Candy building, for example, we have acquired a lot of square footage in different buildings, and we've asked our facilities department to continue to operate in a similar manner without any new staff. So they've actually requested 2 staff members that we're recommending, a housekeeper and a maintenance employee, and that they probably will be focused on the Skull Candy building. That's 45,000 square feet of of, you know, of maintenance, of cleaning that we're going to need. So we also are asking for a full-time grandma request. Grandma stands for Government Records and Management Act, and that is the way that's like a FOIA. If you I'm sure know very well what a grandma request is.
Sure.
But for your listeners, it's any government record that is requested. We're trying to get a full-time person that will be able to answer those requests. We are getting more and more of those every day, and it's overwhelming our current staff, and we're kind of doing that in a shotgun scattered approach. We'd like to centralize somebody to be able to do that too. And like you said, there were 16 requests for full-time employees. Each one of those is vetted out very carefully by the budget committee, and we're recommending eight of those.
Where do some of those grandma requests come from? Is it all local? But we've got some national headline-making court cases here, for example. Is that part of the volume?
It absolutely is part of the volume. There's obviously a lot of interest from the media in some of those high-profile cases. It's kind of increasing everywhere. Most of our requests are local. A lot of those come out of the sheriff's office. When they have an incident, there is usually some kind of discovery that goes on, and that includes a grammar request. It's mostly local. We get a lot from the media, and most of those we are able to turn around in a timely manner.
So, you know, with the $100 million total on the budget, you mentioned a lot of that is an increase due to the emergency services sales tax revenue. I see the number you list in the presentation is $16.5 million. Is that more than expected? Because I think I was remembering it was expected to bring in $7 million this year, and that was a half-year total. So how is that going, I guess?
That's correct. You're absolutely right. In 25, in the current fiscal year we're in, we are only going to realize half of the year in revenue. So next year we are planning on a full year of that tax, and it is 16.5. That's about where we thought we would be. We also, as we go through this process from now until December 10th with the council, there will be some conversations around a lowering of expectations when it comes to revenue. We have seen some softening in the market, especially around the tourism ends, around transient room tax, for example. If you follow much, I'm on the board for the Park City Chamber, and we've seen some real softening in our tax revenues. So that'll be also part of what we talk about. So 16.5 is probably a little bit less than we thought we might get maybe a year or two ago. But we're just trying to be very conservative with our projections and meet those projections. It looks like we will meet those projections for 2025, but usually we exceed those in a more of a fashion than we probably will this year.
Yeah. I was hoping you could explain where that money goes as well, because I think if you read some of the opinion pages, there's a colloquial understanding that this is sort of a raise for all the various emergency services that this tax is allowed to go to. Does this mean increased revenue for fire, solid waste, all those different things? How does that work?
Yes, it can, and there are very strict rules around how that can be spent. It is intended to meet we would love to have that benefit the community as we are impacted by tourism, whether that's transit or transportation. We have a lot of solid waste impacts that come with tourism, with Airbnbs and hotels. We'd love to really benefit the community with that tax. What we're planning on doing this year, and I'm still proposing this to council, is to do, if you remember a couple of years ago, we did an agreement with the three fire districts to also provide emergency medical services, ambulance services, and that impact has been on us for 3 years. We've actually used general fund monies for that, and we're now able to use this tax for that that money, which will free up other monies that we need for the general cost increases and trying to reflect these facilities and these other needs we have. So the emergency services sales tax, it can be spent on search and rescue, it can be spent on solid waste, it can be spent on fire and EMS, it can even be spent on police services that are a reflection of mitigating the impacts of tourism.
So it sounds like the focus will be on the EMS aspect as far as who's getting that money this year.
That's correct. That's a $5 million obligation that the county has every year to those three districts with to to provide those services between the, it's over $1 million each for their personnel, and then we're also supplying some ambulances and other things as well. So we're almost in the $5 million range just for that alone. So of the 16.5, $5 million of that is obligated to meeting that EMS need.
Yeah, and a lot of people are curious about Recycle Utah's future with the looming eviction date next year. Is there any area of the budget that is dedicated toward resolving that deadline?
Yes, absolutely. We are going through a master planning process internally with some key staff. Jana Young, the deputy county manager, is leading that effort, and we are looking at recycling. It's maybe the impetus did come from Recycle Utah and their change, but we're still hopeful that they will be an important part of recycling in the basin especially. But we do want to put more resources towards solid waste and recycling food waste as well. That's something that's ramping up and becoming more and more important in our community. So this tax can be used for that, and we are proposing to use that, especially and even next year.
For the satellite collection facilities that you might want to increase.
That's right. We call it a hub and spoke. It may not be exactly what it ends up being, but we do want to have various collection facilities around the community, and then if we can utilize Recycle Utah, either in a new location or in other ways throughout the basin, we'd like to do that.
Gotcha. You do have a slide on what's not in the budget. I think the two things that we haven't mentioned are, you know, I guess a wholesale county courthouse remodel there. I think you're referring to the one in Colville. And then no funding for the Park City Senior Services building. Is that something that's going to, the bill will have to be footed by the municipality, I guess?
Well, yes, and there's probably some ongoing conversations around that. I wanted to make sure and call that out, that there's nothing in there, because there has been talk that there might be a request coming from Park City Municipal to the county, whether that's furnishings or part of the building or ongoing operations. We just don't know. So I wanted to make sure council knew that that wasn't in there, and that they may want to have a conversation around that. Some of the things that are in there is childcare, for example. We had a robust conversation last week about childcare, and Jana Young as well did a good report on some of the community and the way the community is meeting this need. So that's one thing that is in the budget. But we will have to talk about all of those little pieces and make sure the council's comfortable with what is and what is not in the budget.
Of course, this is also all hypothetical, as you mentioned, what we're talking about, because the council has to, is it a deadline at the end of the year? They must adopt it by December?
That's correct.
Okay, mm-hmm. So you've got several meetings scheduled over the next few months. Which areas, you mentioned there could be flexibility on the senior services building, depending on council's feelings. Are there other areas where you expect there to be some changes?
We're looking at maybe ramping up some of our short-term rental conversations. We've purchased the software, and we've hired an employee that's in our code enforcement department that's going to be focused on short-term rentals. There might be more that we can do with that. We have some road projects that are pretty exciting between Old Ranch Road and there's a road in the South Summit area called Hallam Road, which would connect 248 with Francis, that would really take some traffic off of 32 in Camas and some other feeder roads that go around that. That's pretty exciting. We're finishing up the sheriff's office and the attorney's office expansion building. That'll be completed next year. And that also comes at a tremendous cost, but it's going to be such an incredible benefit to what the sheriff's office and attorney's office does.
And actually, I do want to ask, lastly, on the budget, I didn't see anything in the presentation about facilities related to the Dakota Pacific project. I mean, there's the Skull Candy building, which is next to it, but the county's also got to contribute some money for some of the podium above the park and ride, an expanded transit center, things like that. Is that in this budget, or is that a cost that's farther down the road?
It's not in this budget, and it is probably a cost that is further down the road, but it's absolutely something we have to address sooner rather than later. We actually do have a work session on October 22nd that will talk about some of the revenue sources and the responsibilities that we have in the public-private partnership and the civic responsibilities and some of the exciting opportunities we have in the Kimball Junction area to make that more of the heart of the basin of a walkable community and enliven that, especially as we get closer and closer to the Olympics. We're really excited about some of the opportunities we have in the Kimball Junction area, and of course those will come at a cost to the county as well.
Gotcha. And I also wanted to mention on the budget, or not on the agenda tomorrow, the spoil to soil hearing continued from a couple weeks ago. What is the expected outcome of this? Is the county recommending a shutdown of that composting facility, or is it going to be some time to come into compliance?
Well, I think the recommendation from the staff remains that the staff believe there is enough evidence that the conditional use permit should be pulled. The council is acting in a quasi-judicial role. They have the jurisdiction and the responsibility to make that determination. I think the staff has made it clear during the first presentation about a month ago, and then in the staff report that's available now, that this to the staff is very much a more of a landfill than a recycling facility, and we'd like to have them have the consequences of those 50 code violations that the staff has recorded in the staff report. So again, the council has all the opportunity. They've given this the owner operator some additional chance and time to cure the operations, and we believe that has shown that the violations remain, and we'd like to see those cured very soon.
Yeah, it sounds, I mean, they could have voted to pull permits last time. It seemed like they didn't want to. They wanted that code violation information kind of presented in a different fashion, I think, sort of cleaner. So does it seem like this won't be a vote to revoke tomorrow?
I just really couldn't say. The council has the opportunity to hear what's been done since the last meeting and to make that determination. Again, from the staff perspective, I think there's enough evidence that the CUP should be pulled.
All right. And anything else you want to mention at this point?
We do have and we're going through an active transportation process. We'd like to get any kind of comments from the public on active transportation in the community, especially around the basin. You can go to summitcounty.info and make any comments you have about active transportation. And we also wanted to call out that for folks to look for the ballots. They've been mailed and they should be in the mail anytime. Obviously, the election is on Tuesday, November 4th. We hope everybody takes the time to vote.
And if anyone does that by mail and returns it by mail, do that early, because the clerk's office needs it on the day of the election by, I think, 8 p.m., 5
p.m. That's absolutely true. Yeah, and the sooner the people get it, the better. We can kind of spread that work out as much as we can between now and November 4th.
Definitely. All right. We've been speaking with Summit County Manager Shane Scott about tomorrow's council meeting. Thanks, Shane.
Connor, thank you. Have a great day.
New federal guidelines allow anyone 6 months or older to receive a COVID vaccine after consulting with a health professional. For those who may have missed its drive-through Vax&Go clinics, the Summit County Department of Health is still offering COVID-19 and flu shots. Residents can get vaccinated with or without insurance at any of the three health department locations in Colville, Camas, and Park City.
With a visit, you will have a quick chat with one of our clinicians, and they will get you set up with the best version of the COVID vaccine for you. And then based on your individual health situation, there are two different versions of the COVID vaccine.
That's Health Director Phil Bondurant on Local News Hour yesterday, describing the new shared clinical decision-making model recommended by the Centers for Disease Control Vaccine Policy Committee for the COVID vaccine specifically. Jim O'Neill, the CDC's acting director, approved the policy this month. It allows anyone 6 months or older to get a COVID shot as long as they or their guardian speaks with an approved health provider first. Previously, patients would have needed a prescription or prove that they had another condition that put them at risk of severe complications from COVID.
I'm actually an advocate of this current policy or the framework that they're using, because what it does is it puts the power to decide what's best for the individual in the individual's court. They can make that decision based on the information that's available, Or if they're a little uncertain with all the things that are going on, they can always contact the health department and speak with one of our clinicians about what it means.
The new COVID vaccine policy went into effect just before the health department's drive-through clinics, October 7th through the 9th. Bondurant says the events reached more than 1,000 Summit County residents this year. It was the third consecutive year of Vax and Go. And the Summit County Health Department is a financial supporter of KPCW. On the phone with us now is the superintendent of South Summit School District, Greg Mon. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. So the board had its October board meeting yesterday, and it looks like you had an update on enrollment numbers. Are they up? Are they down? What can you tell us about, you know, the state of the schools?
Well, enrollment is down a little bit, which seems to be the trend in a lot of districts across the state. So we're down this year by, I think, 51 students. So that's where we're at. We're at just over 1,500. We're 1,516 students as far as our October 1 count goes. And then we'll take a couple more additional counts for the state throughout the year and see where it lands and averages out.
Gotcha. So depending on changes in student population throughout the year, the final numbers come later.
So October 1 is what, you know, they kind of base our finances off of and that. But then, yeah, throughout the year as things fluctuate, there are adjustments made as we meet other reporting deadlines.
I guess besides financial implications, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but enrollment also affects the open enrollment process. Could you explain a little bit for those who might not have gone through it before what that is?
Sure. Also, Utah as a state is a school choice open enrollment state. And so basically the process of that is if a school is at 90% capacity or more, generally the school board will designate that particular school as closed to open enrollment because they need that last 10% as the cushion for mobility, you know, for students moving in and that. And if they're below 90% of that threshold, then boards should and it's formal action, you know, and they should designate the schools as open to open enrollment based on the school choice nature and laws in our state. And so it runs from November to February, and that's kind of a first consideration for those requests. So you have early open enrollment, then you have late enrollment. And so anything that comes in after open enrollment closes is considered late enrollment. And so first priority obviously always goes to the students that live in your boundaries. The next priority goes to those who take advantage of the early open enrollment time frame.
Yeah, and it looks...
So our board...
Go ahead. Schools in South Summit are open based on enrollment numbers.
They are. That was the recommendation based on you know where we're at in our capacity in each building, and the board last night they took action to declare each of the schools is open to the early open enrollment.
All right. I'd imagine it's a popular choice for maybe teachers who have kids but who don't live in the district boundaries, or people who maybe live close to the boundaries. Because there's not multiple middle schools or elementary schools, do you really see a lot of open enrollment use in South Summit?
Well, so we do get open enrollment applications, and it really does kind of depend on the school. Generally, our school over in Silver Creek historically gets quite a few early open enrollment applications. We do also get them in the Camas Valley schools. But you are right. A lot of, in particular in the Camas Valley, the majority of those students on that are taking advantage of the early open enrollment are either children of employees or they live close to the boundary. So where part of Woodland is Wasatch, part of Woodland is South Summit. We get students that apply for that open enrollment period that live right there, kind of close to that border, that boundary line. It's certainly a lot different than the schools on the Wasatch Front, because of the proximity of how close they are to schools on the Wasatch Front in other districts. We don't have that.
I imagine that'd be a tough commute for kids living on the Wasatch County side of Woodland. I'm curious about Silver Summit Academy because I don't have kids in school or kids at all. What is Silver Summit Academy as opposed to your, regular elementary, middle, and high school? I know there are some differences there.
Silver Summit, we have a Silver Summit Elementary and a Silver Summit Academy, and they share a footprint. So it's really just, we consider it Silver Summit School. It's just the same. It's just like the schools in Camas Valley. It's not a district charter school. It's not a private school. It just happens to be the school or the school that that is in that part of our school district boundary. And so it's a lot of times people will think that it's a charter school because in the name of the secondary side of the school has academy in it, but it's not a charter. It's just a regular public school.
Size wise,
it's, as far as enrollment goes, it's much smaller than our Camas Valley schools. And we'll see what happens with the growth that we see in there in the Silver Creek area. We anticipate seeing some growth there, but who knows? Only time will tell.
I guess that could change enrollment. Your counterparts in North Summit are going through some bonding for a new high school. With enrollment down, I'd imagine there's no short-term need, but any sense for when that might need to happen in South Summit?
Our Silver Summit buildings, they're pretty recent, recently renovated, remodeled, and they're not as old as the Camas Valley buildings. And the Camas Valley buildings, they're all within a very similar time frame as far as being built. And so our board has worked in, during some working sessions and that on coming up with a 15 or 20 year facility plan. And so we recently put out an RFP proposal or request for a feasibility study on what it would take as far as in particular looking at starting most likely with an elementary school at some point in the future on one of the properties that the district has. We have some property in Francis, some here in Canvas, and we have some in Oakley. So the board's aware and they're talking about the future plan because back when the schools were all built in the Camas Valley, they had, as I understand it, a lot of oil and gas money coming in, and that's just not the case anymore. And so our board wants to be fiscally, responsible and prudent. And it would be impossible to build three schools within a really short period of time again. And so they're looking at it that way as to, based on the age of the buildings, we've had some assessments done on the buildings, and based on that, what's the best plan moving forward to avoid getting too far down the road and having issues with multiple buildings at one time.
That makes sense.
The other thing I wanted to touch on the agenda yesterday was it's college application week. Did that resolution pass?
Yeah.
And how are you participating?
It did. It did. And, you know, it's interesting because that has changed over the years. You know, we used to have a college application month, and now it's a college application week. But it's a statewide event. You know, it's designed to, it's specifically for high schools, and it's designed to help students complete college applications, financial aid forms, things like that. So like there's a FAFSA, you know, the free application for federal student aid. They have an, you know, events that help students and parents fill that stuff out. It is geared, one of the things that it's geared for is first generation or low income students, low, you know, families. All of our students participate that if we try to get them to participate. And we have a high participation rate. Last night someone had said it was in the 50%, which is higher than the state average. Which was great news. And basically students are given dedicated time to, you know, during the day to work on at least one college application with access to counselors and college representatives, sometimes being able to help provide some assistance and answers to them.
All right. We wish everybody,
it's a great program.
Yeah. We wish everybody good luck with that. Anything else that you want to mention? We're just about out of time.
I think things are going well. The year's obviously off to a good start, and we're already almost a quarter of the way through, which is crazy to think about.
Well, all right. Well, we've been speaking with South Summit Superintendent Greg Bond. Thank you so much for coming on this morning.
Thanks, Connor. Take care.
In the studio with us, we've got Steve Richardson. He's the executive director of the Christian Center of Park City, and Susan Hammer, director of counseling. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Connor. Great to be here.
Thank you.
So you've got an upcoming event for folks at the Blair Education Center, Healthy Minds, Healthy Lives. Could you explain when this is and what it will cover?
Yeah, we're super excited. It's a brain health event, and we're going to be talking about four different strategies to help improve and optimize your brain health. And we've got amazing experts that are going to be panel and be available for Q&A. Nancy Engel, who's a certified integrative health coach. Lauren Zeeks, who specializes in concussions and long COVID. And chronic illness. Lauren Feenstra, who's one of CCPC's clinicians. Nadine Nye, who does speech therapy. And then Rob Harder, who's going to be doing our moderating. He's also from CCPC. So neurofeedback and mental health, sleep issues, concussions. There's going to be lots of great discussions.
Could you explain more about what neurofeedback is? It says it's a form of treatment, but is it like a talk therapy? Is it chemical in some way? Is it pills? What is it?
Yeah, no, it's super cool. It's biofeedback, basically, and we offer two different types, ILC and MCN. MCN is the Othmer method, which a lot of people know it from that. And basically what they do is our technicians will put electrode kind of things on your head, and you get to watch a screen and see how your brain is functioning, doing different things, talk, sound, touch, tactile things. And what you're basically doing is you are interrupting what has become a habit of your brainwave, and you're looking at it and you're retraining your brain to be more healthy.
So it's monitoring, or is it stimulating it with pulses?
It's stimulating.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Very low-grade stimulating, where you basically don't even feel it. You know, it's non-integrative. It's drug-free. It's really safe.
Have you tried it?
I have.
Cool. So, you know, could you say more about, is it a free event? Will you get to try it there, or will it be more of a panel lecture format?
Yeah, it is a free event. We will not be having any opportunity that I know of to actually try it. The panel is going to be coming with just some expert tips and tools that people can actually implement right away.
It's not something where you will have to like take that information and go and actually have an appointment. But it's, they're going to be able to answer any kind of questions you have. So like if you have a particular issue, like sleep, they'll be able to address your concerns.
Cool. How'd you get the idea for this program?
Yeah, so the idea came from us launching Neurofeedback back in January. And similar questions to what you're asking, where people were saying, well, why? You know, I hear there's two different types. One of them has talk therapy, one of them doesn't. It's just by itself. You go in, you spend 30 minutes, you get this intervention type thing, and then you're gone, and it's not even part of talk therapy. So what does this really have to do with the brain? And we realized, okay, it's not just about neurofeedback. Our goal is not to push one thing that the Christian Center is doing. The Christian Center is a nonprofit. Our goal is to have people be healthy. Whether it's mental health, emotional health, relational health, spiritual health, physical health, we want them, and we partner with as many other organizations as we can. So we thought, well, let's bring in some of those other organizations. Let's talk from our point of view. Let's talk from other point of view. Let's talk about different things people can do, no matter what they're facing, to be able to feel healthier in their mind and in their body.
Yeah. You mentioned, you know, the Christian Center does offer counseling services for those who don't know. So you've launched this with some of your patients.
You got it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So some of our clinicians are trained. A number of our clinicians are trained in both models. And we've launched this as one of the other things that we do. So a lot of people don't realize that as the Christian Center, our job is, as Susan always says, is to fill gaps. It's not necessarily just specialty. It's not just one thing. So we take patients from 6 years old up. We see families. We see couples. We see dating individuals. We see individuals. We deal with a lot of different issues that people might come with, bring to us. Some people will want in Christian counseling. Some people are wanting non-spiritual counseling. We do it all, and we want to be here for anybody, whatever their needs are. And so we found one more technique, one more opportunity to try to help people to live that thriving, better life that each one of us want.
How do your clinicians go about identifying the right candidates for neurofeedback?
Usually we're having now people who are asking us for neurofeedback. We have on our website a full web page that is all the information that you might need about neurofeedback and what it could potentially do for you. So we actually have people coming to us because they've heard of it before. Just a little personal antidote. When my children were in high school, who grew up here in Park City, had concussion family, we were driving all the way down to Lehigh to get neurofeedback for treatment. And it's so exciting to be able to offer that here in Park City now.
Is it the first in the area? I mean, I think there are some private organizations around, but...
Yeah, different focus, though. I mean, I think for us, we're very focused on mental health. So the focus may be slightly different. Yeah, there's other people who are doing it for optimizing sports. We're doing it for wellness.
And just one more time for the listeners, what's the information on the Healthy Lives, Healthy Minds event and when and where?
Yeah, it's going to be at the Blair Education Center at Park City Hospital, which is 900 Round Valley Drive. It's from 6 to 8, and it's free.
All right. And any RSVP?
No.
Asked? All right.
No.
Just show up, as we do with everything. We're here for everybody at every time. And I want to remind people of that. If you've got insurance, if you don't have insurance, if you're struggling to make ends meet, if you're just looking for the top quality counseling, we have sessions as low as $4. We take a lot of different kinds of insurance. We want to be here for everybody. And so this is one opportunity to be here for everybody.
All right. Steve Richardson, Executive Director of Christian Center, and Susan Hammer, the Director of Counseling. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks, Connor.
Thank you.
Uber drivers can expect UDOT to turn on a new traffic light on North 40 this week. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has more.
The Utah Department of Transportation installed a traffic light at the intersection of Coyote Canyon Parkway and US 40 and plans to turn on the signal by the end of this week. UDOT Regional Spokesperson Wyatt Woolley says the traffic light outside the Coyote Ridge neighborhood just needs a little more work before it's ready to go.
We have to wait for it to dry out, and then we got to paint some lines on the roads.
After that, UDOT will do some testing to make sure it's working as it should.
So hopefully, if everything goes according to plan, it should be up and running by this Friday, if not next week.
The The light is intended to make it safer for people to turn left into and out of the neighborhood. According to a survey UDOT conducted this summer, nearly 70% of Wasatch County drivers say they've experienced close calls on North 40, including dangerous left turns and vehicles crossing the center line. Separately, UDOT is considering whether to add concrete barriers down the middle of that stretch of highway. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.